Mr. Hitchcock, Reel 4. We're talking about your time at the Dataist Kabbalah at Loughton St. Mary's.
Kabbalah.
Kabbalah, yes. Sorry.
That means Kabbalistics is the art of coding.
Right, I see the origin. Now, you mentioned the other thing. You do some drill. Was there any... how did you take to drill? I mean, you've not had any formal training before. Did you understand the point of it? Were you able to do it?
I thought it was quite pointless, really. We understood that when you're moving people around, they move together. But apart from that, we didn't do much in the way of drill.
Even what you did?
Even what we
pointless.
Did. What we did, we thought, well, all right, we'll bear with this.
And you mentioned sport. Was sport
oh, one sport? Thing I did, I forgot to mention, one thing that I did there was to learn how to shoot. And I went, one part of the training was to learn how to fire a gun. I fired 3 rounds at a target, which I couldn't see, and that was the end of shooting.
Lee Enfield, was it?
Yes.
And you couldn't see it because?
It was rather a murky day, a long way away, a murky day, but I could, my eyes, one of the reasons I suppose why I was a coder was that I wore glasses. My eyesight wasn't all that good. But it was good enough for the Navy.
And that was the only weapons training you
got? That was the only weapons training.
What about seamanship training? Was there any of that at all?
No.
So when you'd done none at...
We learnt a little about knots, I think. I learnt how to tie knots, but very little. We didn't go in any boats, we didn't do any rowing, there was nothing of that kind. It was exclusively a short course, and it was a short course.
When did you finish the course?
In January.
So about two months.
Yeah, well, it was a bit marginally more, perhaps getting on for 3. But it included the Christmas holiday, and it included 1 week of workship.
Tell me about that.
Workship, the 3 groups were divided up into those who ran the cookhouse. That meant not cooking, but washing up. Those who did the outside work, and those who worked in offices. So that working ship, we drew a short straw. We worked in the cookhouse, which meant getting up early.
This is for the camp?
For the camp. And I remember my job for 1 week in a low... Remember, this was almost a prefabricated set of buildings. It was a camp built specifically for the war. There were a lot of them around in that area. HMS Black Cat was one. More of that anon. And we were in a very low, hot, steamy room early in the morning, washing up. So we washed up after breakfast, we washed up after dinner, we washed up after the evening meal. And I remember I was given to washing up knives and forks. And handled something like 1,000 pieces of cutlery 3 times a day, washing that lot up by hand in huge sinks full of hot water, very little soap, and you've got to get them clean. We also had a steam oven which did the plates, so the guy on the plates created more and more steam, so it was a pretty hot sort of thing, and you came out reeling some 2 hours later, so you'd had enough when you'd done that job. So you did about 6 hours or more a day working in the cookhouse.
Now, how did you get on with your fellow recruits or fellow coders to be?
We're all mainly young, the one or two older end. There's one chap, I can't remember his name, came from Liverpool, and I got on quite well with him. He was elderly, but he came from a rugby playing family. He actually played fullback for Liverpool. That's rugby. Some of the others lived in Manchester, and they had home leave, as I had. I was able to get home leave, but more of that anon. And the guys who lived in Manchester, they would catch the last train back to Loughton St. Mary's at night. There were trains in those days, and you'd see them on a Saturday night saying goodbye to their wives on I remember which station now. I remember the name later. On the Manchester Railway Station, saying goodbye, and then the first station down the line, somewhere like Urmston, a lot of young ladies would get on, coming from the local dance, because people travel by train, and they'd be leaning out of the window, come in here, my dear, come in here, and they'd just been kissing their wives. I thought, that's war, isn't it? That was my first real introduction to the disturbance of war.
And you got on reasonably well with them.
Yes.
I mean, different backgrounds, but...
Different backgrounds. I was from... There were a lot of lads from grammar schools. One lad I was with in Billy Butler's, to go back to those days, he was a printer. And he was going to be a reporter, he said. That was his life. And we got on famously.
So there was no bullying or...
No bullying.
What about the instructors? What did you think of them, both the sort of way they kept discipline and their skills as instructors, particularly the technical ones?
At the time, I... I suppose rather grudgingly bore with them. But I got on pretty well with all the instructor branch, because I happened to play rugby for a man called Ron Mabbott. And Ron Mabbott was one of the head of the instructors. He was a lieutenant in the Royal Navy, and he was quite a good. I think he'd even had a trial for Wales as a second row forward. And he asked me, he said, you play rugby, do you, young man? So I said, yes. He said, well, come and play with us. I said, well, I'm not very keen. He said, why? Yeah, you play rugby, don't you? I said, yes, because I broke my collarbone. The last thing I did playing for Skipton was to break my collarbone playing against one of the Duke of Wellington's regiment. I said, and this great hulking soldier tackled me after the ball had gone, long after the ball had gone, so I wasn't ready for it. I said, I just wonder. Oh, he said, you'll be all right. He said, you play rugby. So I played rugby, nursing a shoulder, which the collarbone, which was still pretty sore. So every time I tackled on the left side, I got an electric shock down my arm.
Was it a good standard of rugby they played?
Not really. It's a bit like coarse rugby. But nonetheless, I played for the station side, and we played all the stations around, and all comers, army sides, naval sides. We played black cap in the swamp, because South Lancashire, although it's renowned for its rugby league, still doesn't have very well, or didn't in those days, have very well drained grounds, and especially in these new establishments. So you waded through the mud and you played as best you could.
Now, we got to that from the instructors. What did you think of the instructors? I mean, how good were they? How did they treat you?
We were treated well. No problems with regard to discipline. They
were
friendly.
They weren't strict.
No. They didn't have to be. The course was so arduous, we're knackered all the time.
Did they know this stuff? I mean, did they really know this stuff, or were they just two pages ahead of you?
I think they knew how to code and decode using naval code, but how to actually put it over, they wouldn't have had teacher training courses, anything of that kind. So it was just a question of get fell in, come in, this is what it's all about, get stuck in, lads, get your books out, and so on and so forth. It was a bit rough and ready, but nonetheless, it provided you with a knowledge which, I suppose, it enabled you to bed down into the Navy, so that you, when you actually met the real Navy, you were not overawed too much.
Did you see much of officers while you were at...
Apart from Ron Mabbott, not really, no.
Now, anything else? What about at the end of the course? How were you assessed?
I had an exam. I had to decode. We did Morse. You had to pass at least. You had to do Morse up to a certain standard. And so you sat in a room with your earphones on. Morse came to you. You didn't have to send a signal. you had to receive a signal, and you had to take down the code. So it came out in code, and then it was presumably it was marked. It was really pass or fail. But I remember the Killikin charge saying to one or two of us, yeah, you did pretty well. You've got full marks in this and all right in that, and so on and so forth.
Now
very informal.
This is early days in your naval career, but had you ever thought of taking a commission, or had it ever been suggested to you that you might be suitable material for taking a commission?
I asked that of the first chief petty officer I met when I went for my medical, when he announced that I had joined the Royal Navy. And I said, well, what's the chance of taking a commission? And he said, we can all rise in the Navy, you'll have your chance. That was the beginning of it. Later on, as I might say, we'll come to that again.
But at this stage, it was still in the future that any chance of a commission, you weren't made aware of any chances while you were...
I was made aware in HMS Royal Arthur that one of our number, who had been in the CCF and knew how to march, that he'd come from a public school, that he thought that he ought to have a commission, and in fact, at that time, he had applied to be considered. Later on, I found that he didn't get one.
So any chance you were going to have hadn't come yet. So you passed out, and this was in January 44. So what was your next move?
My next move was leave. From leave, I went to Pompey Barracks when I met the Royal Navy.
That's Victory Barracks, is it?
It's Victory Barracks. It's a main barracks for in Portsmouth, and I was allocated a place to hang my hammock in a communications branch, and we did some desultory communication work, but largely did nothing, and just hung around and told stories to each other and went on leave. I was able to go and visit my uncle, who lived fairly near to Portsmouth, so I was able to get evening leave, and they were pretty generous with the leave. I got Friday Wilds and Saturday Wilds, but I didn't go back to Lancashire where I'd lived in Cone.
So how long were you at Portsmouth?
About a fortnight, so, and I was transferred.
Where were you transferred to?
HMS Mercury 2. That's above Petersfield. Mercury is on the top of the down. It's about, I don't know, it seemed to me to be up in the clouds, 700 feet up, something of that order. One of the highest parts of the downs. High up above Petersfield, very remote. We lived in a Nissen hut. Again, it was a communication place, and it was simply a holding operation. I was given a job, and my job was to work in a place called Siberia, which was the junior officers' mess. I never saw many of the junior officers, and I didn't have to go on parade.
What were you doing there? Just acting as a
skivvy. I used to use what they call bluebell. Any polish in the Navy is called bluebell or gumption. So my life became surrounded by bluebell, gumption, and boot polish.
Basically, just cleaning their gear.
Just cleaning boots and shoes, and looking out onto the training of the naval parties, where you had sailors in khaki wearing little round hats, jumping over fences in the snow. It was pretty cold up there. And we could get leave down into Petersfield if we wished. But generally, you stayed in, went into the canteen, met the submariners, who sat absolutely exclusive as a group with their sailor hats crammed down on their heads, so only their ears and their brows were showing. They were also very proud to wear their white sweaters, white polo neck sweaters, which they were allowed to do, to show that they were cut above everybody else. And of course, they got more money, or had been when they worked, they got more money, they got double pay, been in the submarine service, and so they could stay longer in the canteen, drink more beer than anyone else, and roll back, sleep it off.
Now, were you actually learning anything at Mercury 2, or was it just purely basically working as an officer's servant?
I learnt nothing much, except what the real Navy was like.
What do you mean by that?
Well, you met people there who'd come from service, from people coming in. And in our Listen Hut, the first sight I saw when I went in there was some of these new recruits coming up. We came by lorry from back of a lorry from Portsmouth. Met this strange scene, rather reminiscent to me of Macbeth, where this two-badge signalman was sitting with what they called, I found out later, his wings, or winger. And they sat around a stove. It was a coke stove in the middle of this Nissen hut with a pipe going up through the roof, and he had a bucket boiling his whites, doing his whites. And he sat round here, casually stirring the whites. It was going dark, and his winger sat alongside him, and the conversation would go like something like this. Bigger battle wankers at Gus, aren't there? And the winger would go, ha 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 ha. Yes, yes, that it went on in that vein. And not the same at Pompey, are they? Yes, yes. And this book, it was like a scene out of the only two witches, but it was like a scene out of Macbeth, bubble, bubble, toil and trouble. And this went on. And I thought, where the hell have I landed in? And that was HMS Mercury 2.
Now, you were there from sort of late January-ish.
And then till beginning of February. It was not there very long. I was called then to become a crew and to go down to Portsmouth, where to hang around for a day or two, again, doing very little, hang around until the tannoy, which was going constantly, and you had to keep your ear to the tannoy, and the names will be read out, and eventually it will be ordinary coders, an ordinary coder then, because I obviously hadn't done any real sea time, and it would come out, ordinary coder, Hitchcock, Sandwell, and one or two others. These names will be called, report to the regulating office immediately. So you'd rush off there, and I said, well, what's it all about? Join the queue, you see. What's it all about? Your turn will come up. What's it all? Oh, Hitchcock, yes. You have been sent to HMS St. Albans. Oh, what do I do? Well, you can have some leave. Go home on leave. You get embarkation leave. Take this file with you. You've got a file. And I got a warrant to go. They wrote out a warrant, and I went off on the train from Portsmouth back to Cone. Came back again, and I said, "Well, when do I go to St. Albans?" Having reported back, "Oh well, you hang around a little, hang around, hang around, hang around," and nothing happened. So I didn't even go to St. Albans, which I learnt was on the East Coast, and it was a drogue towing vessel. It was an American four-stacker. So although I was drafted to St. Albans, I never went there. And so I hung around for another few days, took my leaves, had a Friday while or two, and into the beginning of March, I think it was as of the end of February, beginning, probably the end of February, I heard that, again, similar process, over the tannoy, report, and papers, HMS Narborough. And I was then told to report to the parade ground. And there was a fairly hiatus, a day or two, and then report back. And of course, if you're in Portsmouth, you had to go to divisions early in the morning. That was the first thing that happened. They were a bit rather desultory, but you had the bands playing, marine band, and we used to tag on at the end, not quite knowing what we were up to. But eventually, we were marched to the harbour station in Portsmouth, which was very close to Pompey Barracks, marched to harbour station, and there joined a train which took us up to London. We got a crew, and the crew was made up of communications ratings and other ratings, a whole gang of us, some raw recruits like myself and others experienced people, and we joined up in London with three other, well, with two other trains. That was one from Chatham, one from Devonport, and these three trains were hooked together and wound their way slowly northwards past places that I knew, up into the Pennines, near where I lived, near where I used to go rock climbing, potholing. It was really quite evocative, this long, snaky train. And we found out that we got crews for HMS Narborough, HMS Rupert, and HMS Whittaker. Rupert was Chatham, Whittaker was Devonport. And we arrived at Stranraer.
Stranraer.
And we were put onto a ferry at Stranraer and sailed across to Bangor, got on a Northern Ireland train which seemed to be even narrower and more uncomfortable than the English trains, and ended up, after a journey of about 24 hours, we went through odd places on the way, where we were occasionally fed and watered, but it was a journey of 24 hours, and we eventually ended up at the side of a railway, that's all, a place called Lissahalley, where there was a jetty in what was the River Foyle. The loch was further, Loch Foyle was a little further down. It was a, I suppose it was a sea area, because alongside were three of the tiniest boats I'd ever thought about. Not as big as the ferry that we'd come across in. And these small boats were Narborough, Whittaker, and Rupert. And so we disgorged ourselves, disembarked from the train, fell down the embankment, picked up our baggage, hammocks and kit bag, that's all we had, and a little ditty case, and scrambled aboard.
Now, what were your first impressions of the Narborough then? This was, I mean, it was your first ship, of course.
How small! God, I'm not going to see in that tiny thing. That it was oily, that you could smell the oil, that it was a warship of a sort, and but didn't have what I imagined a battleship to have, great big guns. It had little tiny guns. Little did I know that the guns weren't any good, but we had... the ship was oily. It had was absolutely jam-packed with metal, and we went down below and down things which I learnt were called companionways, not stairs, not steps, but it was literally a ladder. And there were ominous looking doors with great big handles on them that obviously could be shut, with little holes through the middle which also could be shut. And I went down onto what was a stern mess deck, which was where we first began. Soon afterwards, we were piped, and we learnt to know what pipes were all about. Learnt we were piped on to the quarterdeck, where we met the first lieutenant. The first lieutenant stood up, and I thought he imagines that he's Captain Bligh, and he got his arms behind his back. We'd noticed that he'd got barbed wire around his not straight rings, and not wavies. So we thought, this is a funny sort of a guy. And he was rather, I suppose, plump-faced, weather-beaten, not very old, but of course to an still a young person, 19 by then, to a young 19-year-old he seemed pretty ancient. But he got up, put his arms behind his back and said, "Row, you've joined the Royal Navy. This is a fighting ship," and so on and so forth. He said, "Our mission is to seek action." I thought, what the hell's happening here? I didn't want this. "Seek action. We shall, if we meet the enemy, engage the enemy. Whatever the enemy is, we shall fight." And so on. And he went on in this vein and said, "We expect you to pull your weight, usual kind of up spirits talk." And on the whole, we thought we've really let ourselves in for something.
Now, who was the first lieutenant?
I can't remember his name because he didn't stay very long with us. He obviously went off to fight somewhere else.
It obviously didn't impress you, this this up spirits talk. Didn't up your spirits?
Not really. Up spirits, not really. We thought it was a bit over the top. We thought it was the kind of thing that you see in your local cinema.
So you were joining the crew. Where were the old crew? Because how had it got to Lissa Hulley? Because it had been commissioned in...
The answer to that, there wasn't an old crew. There was no old crew because it had been brought across by a Canadian skeleton crew. And there were a number of these people on board who were showing us the ropes. They didn't need to show me the ropes because it was not necessary with codes. But they did need to show the telegraphists how the equipment worked. They needed to show the engineers in particular how the vessel ran. So that I wasn't involved in that at all. And so we just practiced coding or sat around and generally were thinking, this isn't too bad, after all.
Tell me about the mess decks, because did you have a communications ratings mess deck, or were you in with the others?
We're at the stern of the ship, initially, in a communications mess, which included then the radar mechanic, who later became a petty officer, and the leading telegraphist in charge of the communications. He became a petty officer soon afterwards. But we're all lumped in together.
Now, can you describe the mess deck? What were
The mess decks were bunked. Three-tier bunks, which were canvas, strapped across, what looked like scaffolding. And you lifted, they could be lifted up and they could fasten up where you could swab the floors, which were then steel. Steel floors, lockers underneath, lockers at the ends, and a table. In some of the areas, you had a table down the middle. These were washable. And we actually had a servant for some reason. How that came about, I have no idea. We didn't have him for long, but he came and swabbed the tables down after we had our meals, and he swabbed the floors for us.
Now, what did you think of the bunks as compared to the more traditional hammocks?
I'd slept in a hammock in Pompey Barracks. I'd slept in bunks all the while. I'd slept in bunks in youth hostel. I was quite accustomed to bunks. I just took it in my stride. I didn't really notice.
Which did you prefer? You didn't really...
Hammocks are comfortable, but they have disadvantages. But you're safer in a hammock. You don't fall out of a hammock, but I later found that you can fall out of a bunk.